We would like to acknowledge that All Aussie Hour is recorded on Nipaluna Country, the traditional land of the Muwinina people, and on Lajamanu, Gurindji Country, of which the Walpiri and Gurindji people are the traditional custodians.
We pay our respects to all First Nations people and acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded. From the croc-infested waters of the NT to the wall of vulvas in Hobart, I'm Mel.
I'm Josie, and this is All Aussie Hour.
G'day, Josie.
G'day, Mel. How are you?
Good. We're back for another recording. We're back in the swing of things. It's all happening.
We truly are. Yeah, it's like riding a bike.
It is like riding a bike.
I feel like we're destined to talk at each other in microphones, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I was going to tell you a funny story since I don't have any catch-up to tell you because we saw each other 2 seconds ago.
Tell me a funny story.
So I'm listening to what people call fairy porn, which is those A Court of Thorns and Roses like all those books that are like, there's just a million of them. They're like book talk favorites.
Yeah.
Just like books about horny fairies who fuck and also save the world. And they're great. And I love them. And when we were driving, so we drove from Sydney to Darwin over a course of a week. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of the driving because I love the road trips and Tom likes to go to sleep. So he is a passenger princess. And I was like, well, I'm going to listen to my fairy porn while we're driving.
Yeah.
And so I had it on. And it's like they're the kinds of books for anyone that reads them and loves them. It's like totally normal, just weird fantasy stuff for most of the book. But then there'll be like a slow, sexy build up. And then there'll be this elongated scene of the most outrageously erotic, like R-rated content.
Right. Okay. So it's really great. I haven't read them. I got super one on my bedside graphic, table, but I haven't
graphic.
Read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Super graphic. And I'd only ever really read them or listened to audiobooks on my own. And so I'm listening la, la, la. And then it got to this really like hectic scene involving like blowjobs and God knows what. And Tom wakes up from his nap and he's like, did I just hear the word cock? And then he was just listening. And then it was that shame where someone's listening to like your secret shame, you know, like you're like, I wasn't ashamed of listening to this until you were listening like as an outsider who doesn't get it. And then I'm sitting there like, I don't really want you to hear. It was reminded me of when I was little, like not little, but like 14, and I'd watch like Dawson's Creek and then Mum would walk in and it was like, don't watch my special show that you don't understand and you're going to criticize and you're going to be like, they don't look like teenagers, you know, it was like that, but with a book. So
yeah, don't ruin Pacey for me, please.
No.
Yeah, that is so embarrassing that he woke up during fairy cock.
He woke up to fairy cock. It was not great, but yes. Anyway, nothing to do with what we're talking about today, I assume.
How did you guess? No, not at all. But similar thing happened to me. Julian went to New South Wales for a wedding and he came home pretty late. He's like, oh, guess what I was listening to on the plane? And he presses play on his audio. He's not really an audiobook girly and I am. So I think he's just excited to be like, look, I got one. And out of his phone speaker comes Stephen Fry's voice. And I every night listen to Stephen Fry doing Harry Potter.
Yeah.
But it wasn't Harry Potter. It was like he does like Greek mythology stuff.
Oh, yes, he does. Doesn't he write them?
Yeah, I think he does. But like the bit that Julian pressed play on was like this woman having sex with her son like on a cliff top. And I was like, oh, sounds like some good plane listening. He's like, oh, I fell asleep. I didn't know that it got so weird.
Oh, my God. Can you please tell Julian that I think Tom is reading the same book?
Is it called like Mythos or something?
Yes. Okay. I swear Tom is reading this book and every now and then will stop. Like he's reading it physically. But he'll be like close the book really dramatically and go, oh, that was a bit too much before bed. And I'm like, are you 95 years old? Like, can you relax? Sorry, the Greek mythology is too much for you. You absolutely
Julian's
perish
like,
reading.
I didn't know
porn.
Greek mythology was so full on. I'm like, like literally known for being full on. Like, Have you heard of Oedipus? Oh, anyway, he's in for a rude shock. That's so funny. They're reading the same
book. I'm pretty sure they're reading the same book. I love that for them.
But right now, I mean, if you listened last week, you know what we're doing. We're telling each other stories. They're Australian and they go for potentially an hour. In this case, we hope not, because someone needs the studio.
Ideally under an hour.
But it being me, like, I did 14 pages of research and went into some really boring, like, engineering. And
Engineering.
I'm in my engineering era.
Here we go. I can't
wait. I've moved from, last year I moved from Sydney to, as you know, Mel, yes. I'm telling the listeners this.
Yes.
I moved from Sydney to Hobart. It was a lifelong dream of mine, but I thought, for my first episode, I should do a Tasmanian story. I've wanted to do it for ages. It's actually very timely at the moment. I'm going to tell you about the Tasman Bridge disaster, Mel.
I don't even know what that is.
Really?
Which is great. No, I don't. And that's great, because now it's like a whole fresh story for me that I'm only going to retain your information about.
Yeah.
So I will, if you lie, then I'll believe you.
Okay. Scrap all my research.
Misinformation me.
As opposed to last week where you told me about my favorite sport.
Yes. In which you were just sitting there silently screaming.
No, it was interesting. I didn't know all of that stuff. Well, I knew some of it.
Like, a lot of it I didn't. I knew.
It was interesting. But anyway, some credits, because that's what we do. Mm-hmm. Enjoy Tasmania, which is a little bit of a weird name for a credit about a disaster.
Sure.
Anyway, enjoytasmania.com.au, that is an article called The Tasman Bridge, funnily enough. Ourtasmania.com.au, a Tasmanian Times article by Callum J. Jones. I found one of those really old-timey PDFs of a story. I have no idea where it was originally published. It's fucking amazing. It's called Tragic Sunday by Jim Clark. A Mercury News segment, which was a video I found on YouTube called The Monaro on the Bridge.
Oh, that's ominous.
Yes. A Time magazine article, no byline, rudely, called Bridge of Size. And, of course, good old Wikipedia for this one. That Time magazine article is from 1976. So they're clearly like, who cares about this old-timey journalist?
Yes.
As no byline needed. They're probably dead. Who cares? So the Tasman Bridge. Have you been to Hobart? You have.
I have been to Hobart, yeah.
So you would have seen it, because if you come from the airport.
Also, it's still there.
Yes. The Tasman Bridge is the main bridge in Hobart.
Right.
It connects the eastern shore of the River Derwent with the western shore. So the western shore is Hobart CBD, like basically all the action.
Mm-hmm.
And the eastern shore is pretty much residential, but the airport is on that side.
So a lot of people crossing this.
You do go over the bridge unless you literally arrive in Hobart and don't venture into Hobart.
Never go there.
You just go straight to Port Arthur. Then you
and
wouldn't,
the airport.
You wouldn't see it.
It's very Kath and Kim that time that they're like stuck in the airport and they're just like hanging out.
Yes, exactly. If you're just hanging out.
You in Hobart if you want to.
You won't see the bridge. So it's very busy. According to a Department of State growth report from 2019, it averages 73,029 vehicle crossings per day.
Jesus.
So it's the highest volume road section in the whole state. And it's kind of chaotic. It's like the Sydney Harbour Bridge where the lanes can change.
Oh, yeah. Hate that.
Like at the time of day. So there's like a green arrow most of the day, like peak hour going one way. But then if you come later, that's like a red arrow and you're not allowed to go there and it's scary. There's no like lane dividers either. So if you're on that end lane, there's like oncoming traffic.
Do you ever think about when that happens, like the moment that it changes if you were in that lane? Like this
yes,
obviously mustn't happen, right? Surely.
And it suddenly changes.
And suddenly you're in the wrong lane. Like, I'm like, does that happen? I assume it doesn't, but I always think
this. I don't know. I've never seen it happen, thank God. But I remember the first time I ever drove in Hobart was a few years ago before I lived here, and my mum hadn't moved here either. And we came on a trip together and she made me drive and I was still on my P's, you know, that I got my P's
mom.
Very late in life.
Yeah.
Literally my mid-30s. So I was on my P's in this rental car and it was really dark. Like it's on the way from the airport, it's just like there's like one street light.
Like
so
sheep.
I was already on high, like I was on edge. And then I had to go over that fucking bridge and I hadn't been here much, so I didn't know what lane I need to be in or anything like that. And I was like white knuckling. I'm pretty sure I was speeding because I didn't know where on this rental car the speedo was.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's speed cameras on the bridge. I was just like, I didn't care.
Just like, I'll go at any speed. Like,
white knuckling. But luckily in Hobart, it's like 6 p.m. rolls around and the roads are empty. It's like, it's not like in Sydney where even at like 9 p.m. in Randwick where I used to live, there was so many cars. It's like everyone's inside in Hobart. Like it is that kind of small regional capital city. So there weren't many cars on the bridge that night, but I was still terrified. But at peak hour, that bridge is so clogged. The roads coming on and off it are just like chaos because so many people commute into the main part of the city from the east. And then in the afternoon, everyone's going the other way. So it's chaos. So the first bridge that was in that spot was, I need to show you, where's my phone? It was a floating bridge called the Hobart Bridge. And I just cannot get over the amateur hour that this bridge. It's just like that line. In the
Oh, middle. Was that is huge for a floating bridge.
Yes, huge and just kind of floating.
Basically, what year was that?
That was in the 50s.
Okay.
It was an engineering marvel at the time. Was it? I can't believe it. It looks like a death trap. It used to get like tossed around if it was rough.
Oh my God.
They'd have to close it because it was getting tossed around.
It's just like, whoa.
So obviously that wasn't sustainable. Like there was more, once the airport opened, there was so much traffic. And obviously when more cars started to get on the road, it just couldn't withstand the traffic. It was struggling with water damage. It was just struggling in general. Yep. This bridge was just struggling. So they planned to replace it with a fancy new version. So the channel of water it needs to cross is 50% wider than what the Harbour Bridge has to cross.
Oh, okay. So it's like double.
Quite wide. It's really bigger than that channel.
It's big.
But it needed to be as high as the Harbour Bridge.
Okay.
Because it needed to have boats coming under it, like ships.
Yeah.
So basically it couldn't be the same type of bridge as the Harbour Bridge because it needs to be wider.
Mm.
So there was a lot of like engineering to and fro about what kind of bridge does it need to be. They decided it would have to have piers supporting it from underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And the gaps between the piers, and this is important, it comes into play later. I'm not just being an engineering era because I over-research constantly. The gaps are called spans. So they're all 43 meters wide, but in the middle, at the highest point of the bridge, it's the main navigation span. So that's where ships go through, and that's 94 meters wide. So if you look at the bridge, you see these piers coming, and in the middle, there's like a huge gap. And then either side, the secondary navigational spans, they're 60 meters. So it kind of goes big, little bit smaller, and then all the other ones are smaller.
Yeah.
So they started construction in 1960. The old one was still operational while the new one was being built, obviously.
But they're like, you can't go anywhere
until
so we build the new bridge.
In 1964, August, it was officially open to traffic and the old one was closed and started to be dismantled. I found, this has nothing to do with the Tasman Bridge, but I found this horror story.
Oh my God.
From the Tasmanian Times, just some old lady reminiscing. She said, my grandfather, Cliff Milhouse, was a carpenter. He worked on dismantling the Hobart Bridge, so the Chaos Bridge. In 1964, one day during the work, a huge storm came up. My pop was thrown off the bridge with several others and they clung to the sides.
What?
Though he survived, my pop had a breakdown afterwards and never worked again.
Oh my God.
So horrific. Just like, yeah, my grandfather, my pop was thrown off.
Just thrown off and just clinging for his life to the side of it.
I'm telling you, that was a death trap, that bridge.
Yeah.
So when the Tasman Bridge, the new one, was opened, it was just two lanes were operational. But by December 1964, all four lanes were in use. It had its official opening in March 1965. I think some kind of royal came down and, you know,
just any royal.
Got the scissors and opened the ribbon
like,
and all
send
that stuff.
Second cousin of the Earl of Dukedom.
Yes, he'll do. And that was all good. For 10 years, people enjoyed having their fancy new bridge until the night of Sunday, January 5th, 1975. So as I said, traffic dies down significantly after hours. Like it's quite remarkable. It's like a ghost town when you leave the house after six. So, you know, it's a Sunday, 9 p.m., not super busy on the bridge, which is probably a good thing. But there was still a few vehicles on the bridge and there was also some boats in action, in operation, including a bulk carrier called the SS Lake Illawarra. It was heading north up the River Derwent. So there's kind of, it's a very busy port city, Hobart. And then up the River Derwent, there's like an industrial area. So it was heading up there, carrying 10,000 tons of zinc ore concentrate. And the ship itself weighed something like, hang on, I can't find it. It weighed many, many, many tons as well. Yes. So we're talking tens of thousands of tons worth of ship.
Big ship.
Big ship. It was owned and operated by Australian National Line, or ANL, which was a government-formed shipping line. It had 42 crew members on board, and it was heading for that main navigation span. But it had drifted slightly off course.
Uh-oh.
I'll go into that a bit later, but I wanted to talk about the ship's captain, because when I was first researching this, I was like, his name is written like Boleslaw, like coleslaw, but with a B. And you know when you're just reading something and you're not listening to it? I was like, Boleslaw. And then I'm like, hang on. His surname is Pelc, P-E-L-C. I'm like, that kind of sounds Eastern European. So I looked into it and it's actually Boleslav.
Oh.
I'm like, that makes sense.
Not Boleslaw.
Not Boleslaw.
Someone's so listening, they're like, my name is Boleslaw?
I'm Boleslaw.
I don't appreciate you laughing about my name.
He's actually Polish, okay, which is Polish. My heritage, so I shouldn't be laughing. But yes, Captain Boleslav.
Not Captain Pelc. Boleslaw. Can we call him Captain Boleslaw?
Yeah, let's call him Captain Boleslaw. So he was the captain, mm-hmm. and his actions from this night are kind of recorded in this amazing article, the old-timey PDF that I found, Tragic Sunday by Jim Clark. So he goes over the exact happenings on the ship. And what occurred was, as it was drifting, the captain noticed they were heading into pretty shallow water, which is not ideal for such an enormous ship because it'll get stuck. So the captain ordered his helmsman, Robert Banks, to bring the ship to – and here I go into my nautical era my shipping terms.
Oh, no. You had to do shipping and my nautical
terms. Yeah. So he wanted to bring it to starboard, which I think is
– the left. The left?
Port and starboard.
Port and starboard. But there was this game that you played as a kid, right? It was something like starboard, port, and I swear starboard was on the right.
Was it? I have
no idea. But I don't know.
Idea.
You know what? Anyway, does it matter? I don't think it matters.
It doesn't. He wanted to bring it in one direction,
yep.
basically.
Yep.
And the ship was just not really responding the way he wanted. So I'm quoting Jim Clark's article directly because he just writes it so well. So Pelc noticed he was not in line with the bridge markers, which are there to guide ships through the opening. So that's the navigational span, the big opening. Banks received another order. Steer due north, Pelc commanded. The bow of the ship swung quickly to take up the new heading. Pelc was trying to correct the swing of the ship and at the same time line it up with the markers. But then it swung too far the other way. So he wanted it to go starboard, but it went like really starboard.
Yeah, right.
And so then he said, stop engines. The ship was about 700 metres from the bridge. He turned to Banks and he called for hard a port. I had to Google so many fucking things.
You're like, what is that?
Oh, hang on. Hard a port means like a hard right.
Ah,
so there you go.
So starboard is left. Okay, we've learned something new today.
So he's saying hard a port, hard a port. So he's like, spin it the other way. And this is a huge ship.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's 7,000. I can't believe I was like, this is so boring. I just took out actual,
like actual
interesting
facts
technical facts. Yeah. I think it's like a 7,000 ton ship or something crazy.
So it's not a ship that you can just turn quickly.
It's not like, oh, I'm in my little like Nissan Micra and I'm just going to go like.
my floating Nissan Micra.
Plus they had currents as well. Like there was something to do with like how rough it was. I think it was quite rainy that night. So they were like dealing with the currents of the actual river as well.
Yeah.
Plus this huge ship that was just not obeying. So he's like, he swung the wheel over as far as it would go, but the ship didn't change course. Twice more, Pelc repeated the order. Each time, the ship continued to advance towards the bridge. There was now less than 300 metres to impact.
Oh,
Pelc
God.
Immediately rang through to the engine room and ordered full astern. So I'm like, here we go. I'm fucking Googling again. What is full astern?
Yeah, where's the stern now? Isn't that front?
The stern's the back.
The back. The back. Okay.
So full astern is like putting a Nissan Micra in reverse, basically.
Oh, he's like saying back it up. Okay.
Yeah. So it's like the... I've actually written here, you can't just slam on the brakes, but you can kind of like start to like push back the momentum.
Yeah,
so like all the like things start moving. That still didn't do anything. Pelc ordered another shipwright named Graham Kemp to drop the anchors because that's basically like slamming on the brakes.
Yeah, the last possible thing you can do, yeah.
So there's two anchors, one on each side, port and starboard. So Kemp ran to port, dropped that, and then he ran to do starboard. But at the same moment, the ship was reacting to two kinds of motion. So it was being pulled backwards by full astern. It was still in that forward motion of like trying to turn to the right and trying to turn to the left. One anchor's down. So it basically skidded sideways.
Uh-oh.
And it hit the 18th and 19th pylons of the bridge.
Oh,
and it brought down two of the piers.
So which pylons are these ones? In the middle, the middle ones?
No. So he was way over to the left. He actually started to try to go through the secondary navigation, but he missed it. He actually went through one of the tiny 43-meter ones.
Oof.
And it just slammed into them on the eastern side, I believe. So according to Jim Clark's article, Graham Kemp, who was like this guy trying to drop anchors, he stopped in his tracks. I kind of love this because his instinct was to like run away.
Yeah.
But he was like, no, I was told to drop these anchors. So he continued to starboard to drop that anchor. But at that same moment, 127 meters of concrete roadway, which is 7,000 tons, collapsed from the top of the bridge, and he was crushed instantly.
Oh,
he was 25. Obviously, with 7,000 tons of concrete roadway on top of a ship and already being a very heavy ship, it started to sink. So panic.
Sorry to interrupt, ladies. Producer Alex here. Yeah. I just looked it up. The Lake Illawarra was 7,274 tons.
Oh, yes. Okay. I thought it was 7,000, but then I'm like, if it's carrying 10,000, how does that work?
How does this work?
Anyway, physics, man. I don't know.
I imagine that's the ship size and then plus that, right?
Yeah.
17,000.
So it was 17,000 all up. Oof. And it's whacked into these concrete pylons. Then 7,000 tons of concrete has fallen on top of it. So there's no way that thing was staying afloat. 40-odd crew members start panicking. Jim Clark recounts a couple of the survival stories in his article, Tragic Sunday. Quote, Chief Engineer Max Dalton heard someone yell the ship was going down. Quickly, he scrambled forward to get on deck, but he went the wrong way. He ran into a wall of water. The water swept him backwards down a corridor and he managed to cling onto some stairs. They led to the deck, helpfully. So he went out on deck. He had no life jacket, but he found another man who had one and they jumped over the side.
Oh my God, how lucky is he?
Yeah. Another guy, he was swept off the deck, but he washed up onto one of the surviving pylons and he just hung on there
until
a rescuer came past. Another guy was trying to get the lifeboat off the ship. Half of them had jumped overboard. They were just swimming because they were actually so close to the shore that a lot of them did manage to just swim over and like cling onto rocks. The lifeboat wouldn't release from the ship. So then he gave an order to abandon the lifeboat. He got out of it and he went back onto the ship as it disappeared beneath the waves. And then he kind of like bobbed up and the lifeboat had floated free.
What?
So he scrambled back on board and he survived.
God, they're all just blessed, aren't they?
I know. Someone was looking down on him.
The one that grabbed the stairs that just happened to lead to the deck, God.
There's a few of these stories coming up where you're just like, what did that person do right in a past life?
Yeah,
There's some wild stuff. So as you can imagine, this was all very noisy and a lot of locals had seen, heard what happened. Mm. All these Good Samaritans were jumping in their own boats, like risking their own lives because there's like electrical
there's
wires, crumbling stuff. They're in their little dinghies going out to find, they were there before first responders, going to find survivors. A man named Frank Chamberlain, who lived in Montague Bay, he heard really loud noises, the anchor being dropped, he thinks. So then he says, quote, 5 seconds later, there was a mighty crash, a clap of thunder, we thought, which reminds me of when the Newcastle earthquake happened. My dad thought a tree had fallen on the house. No, Dad, just an earthquake. Yeah. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that episode.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was like, have you done that? And I was like, I don't think
no,
you have.
I haven't done it. And I have my own anecdote about my dad and I've just spoiled it.
Everyone forget you heard that.
Forget it.
Forget
about my dad.
It's gone.
So basically this Frank guy looks out, he sees it sinking, he just goes to his boat, he launches it. He spent more than 3 hours searching for survivors.
Oh, that's so good.
Soon after launching, he saw three men and navigated alongside them. He dragged them aboard and he saw a fourth man at his boat's stern. He reached out to grab him, but the man slipped away.
Oh,
he was
no.
unable to save him. Sadly, 7 crew members from the SS Illawarra died. So as well as Graham Kemp, the man that was going to find the anchor, there was anger. It's actually hard to find their names. It's really odd. But there's a memorial plaque, and that's where I managed to get their names. Angus Campbell, Clarence Madigan, Louis Mendizabal, Arthur Robinson, Thomas Sheridan, and Reginald Turner. all died. Some of them were never found. So obviously there's a lot of drama going on in the water, but as you can imagine, with the bridge suddenly collapsing, there's also some chaos going on top of the bridge. And this is the really wild stuff. So as I said, thank Christ it was the time and the day that it was, like a Sunday night, like 9:30 p.m. It was very quiet on the bridge. If this had happened literally at any other time, it would have been much, much worse. I mean, it was already terrible, but it would have been so bad. So a man named Frank Manley was driving his Holden. This is so Aussie. I can't. Frank was driving his Holden Monaro.
The Monaro. I was waiting for Sylvia. The Monaro to come into play. Yeah. Okay.
Sylvia's in the passenger seat. Sylvia, their daughter Sharon's in the back. Stop. Yeah. Sharon, their daughter's in the back.
Stop it.
And he's driving along and the lights on the bridge were out. And as I said, it was a bit of a rainy night. And they were like, okay, maybe there's a blackout, like a bit weird. He slowed right down. Sensible, Frank. Good on you. Slowed down. And Sylvia was like really weirded out. So she was kind of peering out the side window, just thinking this is weird.
Mm.
Frank was obviously looking straight ahead because he was driving. And a car kind of came up beside him on the lane next to him and just disappeared. So it went like in front of him and then it just disappeared. Like he just saw these lights.
Oh,
disappear.
My God.
And then he also noticed that the white lines on the road had disappeared.
Oh,
I hate
it. At
the same time he noticed that, his wife's looking out the side window and she notices the bridge has disappeared.
Oh, my God.
So she screams, stop, the bridge is gone. This is like direct quote, sorry, from the Monaro and the bridge video. This is him recounting it. She says, stop, the bridge is gone. So he slams on the brakes. The car kind of slides because it's raining, but he stops the car. His front wheels are hanging off the bridge.
No.
And then he says in this interview, he says, she says, put it in reverse. And I said, bugger reverse, get out. So
Frank.
So he opens his door,
what a lucky bugger.
And it's just like, I think it's like 45 meters down and it's just like river. And
I got goosebumps with the car, just the lights disappearing. Because like you said, like with your dad with the tree, it's like you don't actually know what's happening until
your
brain computes it. And it's
your
not
brain
like.
Go, oh, the bridge just collapsed.
Yeah.
Like,
and it's nighttime and stuff. Oh my God. Thank God he was a safe driver.
He
should be an NRMA ad.
I know. Really. I love him.
Bring it back. Be like, this is how you should drive.
So he had to like, because it was just darkness, he had to like kind of go really like way back, hold on to the seat, like slide his way out, got his daughter out. And then they were like just kind of standing there being like waving people down. Another car approaches. This is a Holden station wagon. Big representation from Holden here.
Yeah.
They must have loved this. A man named Murray Ling, his wife Helen, and two of their kids were in the car. He noticed two cars in front of him disappear.
Oh, God.
So he hit the brakes. He managed to stop before the edge, but a car behind him slammed into him, pushed his wheels off the edge. Oh. So it's literally, there's this iconic photo. We'll put it on Instagram. We'll put it in the group. But it's the Monaro and the both of them are hanging off the bridge. And they were hanging there like the next day. And it's just
my gosh.
Iconic photo. So he also gets out and starts frantically waving his arms. And sadly, two cars went past him. One actually swerved around him.
Why?
And they went off the bridge.
Oh.
It would have been so dark. Like, I don't know.
So, yeah. And I suppose you don't think there's not going to be a bridge there. But still, I feel like if I saw two cars stopped and people waving their arms, I'd be like at least slowing down. Jeez.
Yeah, I know. Then Murray saw a bus coming. Full of people. He was kind of ahead. He'd gone ahead of where the cars were.
Yeah.
To try and like mitigate people stopping on the edge. And the bus driver just ignored him. He ran alongside the bus, like screaming. And finally the bus driver stopped and like skidded and ran to the side of the bridge. Luckily no one was hurt.
That bus driver must be like, thank God that man ran up the side.
My God, like Murray doing the Lord's work here.
I know, geez.
And then by then I guess there are enough people and cars stopped. People are alerting traffic.
Yeah.
This is all on one side, however. So I'm like, luckily nothing happened on the other side.
Yeah.
There are enough like first responders blocking off the bridge. But similar to, and the reason I said it's quite timely, there was obviously that bridge collapse in Baltimore just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I'd already planned to do this. And I was like, is this poor taste? But I think it's just interesting because it's like, there's a few cases of this happening.
Yeah.
With ships running into bridges. And there's no real way of knowing immediately how many victims you're looking at.
Yeah.
Especially in Baltimore, like that entire bridge just
the
came down.
The whole thing came down. We, Tom and I, got really into this show called, it's got a terrible name, When Big Things Go Wrong. Not appropriate. Not an appropriate name. I feel like they need to have a little bit of a name change. But it's basically looks at the industrial, like the not the industrial, sorry, the engineering failures of things. And one of them is a bridge that was in America, not the Baltimore one.
The Oklahoma one?
Maybe. And it was nothing ran into it. It was that the structure of the bridge was not, like, it wasn't right for the weight that was going on it over the years. But it's so interesting when you just, these are structures that you just rely on, like, every single day.
I know.
Like, you just don't think about it. And then you do, like, you know, you just trust that they've done the right job of it and then anything could happen. So, like, you can actually, you're right, because you can kind of see why cars would just go past someone because you're not going to think, oh, the bridge is broken.
Yeah. You know, that would be the literal last thing that you would think had happened because it's just wild. So there was obviously these eyewitness reports from Murray and Frank and the people that had had cars go past them. There were the people on the land that had watched it unfold and seen, like they'd seen from their houses, like headlights going down into the river. So in Tragic Sunday, Jim Clark's story, he said police felt it could be four. Then like witnesses were kind of like double reporting cars. So then they thought 11 cars had gone in and they were basically like, we can only rely on reports about people who hadn't arrived home. So if you're expecting someone to come home and they didn't, and that was the same night the bridge collapsed, you'd put two and two together.
Mm.
But then he said, you know, if a whole family was in the car, then you wouldn't know for a few days.
Mm.
So it was just a really awful wait, I guess, for people to
And also for
out.
A small, like not that Hobart's small, but it's like more small town than this if this happened in Sydney at the time especially. So people would have known, like you probably had a high likelihood that you would have known someone involved.
Yeah. And actually it took a few decades to officially confirm the official death toll because that car that went past our friend Frank in the Monaro, they believe it was this local doctor named Thomas Jones. He said in the interview I watched that that was him going past him. So he must have like asked what kind of car he had or something and remembered. But his body was never found or his car.
Well, that's what I was going to ask is how do they not know?
He was just last heard from that night. He worked on one side of the river and was commuting. And so they just put two and two together. So it took, I think, till 2015 for them to recognize that he is an official victim. But in the days following, several cars were found by police and Navy divers. The first contained the bodies of Anthony Sward and his wife, Pamela. They were just 28 and 26. They were newlyweds.
Wow.
A few days later, the car and body of Robert Rezek were found. And after that, the car and body of Joyce, who was known as Joy Stokoe. And then with Thomas Jones being confirmed like decades later.
Because how far are they fall? Like how far are the cars?
Well, I think it was 45 metres.
Right. So it would be like immediately death and impact kind of thing.
In total, four cars went into the water, resulting in five deaths, which brings the death toll, including the crew members, to 12. So I'm going to bring in our friend Gough Whitlam here. He was the Prime Minister at the time.
We love Gough.
And if you're a fan of our old podcast, The Zest History.
and you can actually go back in this feed and listen to it. So.
Yeah, all our old episodes are there. So Gough Whitlam was rogue as fuck. And he was on an official trip to Holland when this happened. And he gave this like off the cuff statement that he was like slammed for because before any investigation happened, he said, quote, "It is beyond my imagination how any competent person could steer a ship into the pylons of a bridge. But I have to restrain myself because I would expect the person responsible for such an act would find himself before a criminal jury."
Jeez.
He was later forced to apologize for speaking out of turn. So that happened in January. In April, an inquiry into the disaster looked at the construction of the bridge. So they were like, okay, who do we pin it on? Is it the engineers? Is it the way it was built? They found that the piers either side of the main navigational span were built and reinforced to be able to withstand collision of 20,000 tons from a ship traveling 9 knots. But no other piers were reinforced that way because it would have been too expensive.
God, so just those middle ones.
Yes.
Yeah. Because I was going to say 20,000, that's more than.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But none of the others were. So, and he went into the ones on the side. Engineers had said the cost would have made the project prohibitive. So it wouldn't have, like, it just would have blown out.
Yeah.
But ultimately the inquiry found the incident had been caused by careless navigation by the Illawarra's captain, Boleslav Pelk. So justice for Goff.
Justice for Goff. He knew what he was talking about.
He said it. Basically, the people doing the inquiry, they said he'd had an impeccable career. So he was 60 when this happened. But basically, to summarize, he just made an absolute clusterfuck of things that night with all his various orders. You know, he hadn't really been watching the currents, and that's how he started drifting in the first place. And then he started with all these orders. The ship lost its steerage, and then it slid out and hit the piers. His punishment was having his certificate of competence suspended for 6 months.
What?
Which doesn't seem enough.
In part, I feel bad for Balslaw because I feel like if you've had an impeccable career.
Yes.
And his main crime here was not paying attention to the currents, because I think everything after that is probably like panicking.
Yeah.
Like you're just trying to fix the problem, right? That's happened. So you're an idiot for not paying attention to the currents, but like it's human error, right? And then it's also kind of human error not to reinforce all of the pylons.
Yes.
In my opinion. So it's kind of like, you know, heaping all of this blame on this one guy who fucked up.
They love a scapegoat.
Yeah, and it's like people fuck up all the time. For someone who didn't have like a long running history of screw ups, I feel kind of bad that he got the blame. But still, 6 months is not very long to punish someone.
And he's pretty blasé afterwards. So this is a quote from Jim Clark's article from him. Quote, "If any time I go back to Hobart, I'll take a pilot with me and let him worry about the bridge," Pelk said. "I understand ANL," so it's the National Shipping Line, "ANL holds nothing against me and I will be given a ship." He continued by saying he did not believe the bridge disaster would cause concern to any officers and crew he might control in the future. Quote, "I am eager to get back to the sea," he added. "All my life I've dealt with facts, and now I know the facts from the inquiry, I can handle them. I've been at sea for 40 years and it's always been a cruel sea. No matter what people say, it's a tough profession." But he never got a ship again. He was quietly retired by the ANL in November 1975.
I take back what I said about Balslaw.
Yeah, he was a little bit blasé.
I don't like him anymore. Yeah.
But there was something, and then when I was up to this part, I couldn't find it again, but there was a bit of like finger pointing at the Premier, who had opted for this kind of pier bridge rather than a suspension bridge because it was cheaper.
Right.
So a suspension bridge wouldn't have
that it's
problem.
Always when they go for the cheaper option, that's when you got to worry.
But I have no idea where I read that, and I cannot attribute it to anything. Maybe I dreamt
it. Amazing.
I don't know.
Maybe I made it up.
I could have pulled it out of my ass. Anyway, so clearly a tragedy. 12 people had died, but it was it's to this day a very unique disaster, because in like the record books of history, never before had a disaster divided a city. So there was no bridge.
Oh, yeah,
and as
of course.
I said, it was the only bridge at the time. There was another one 90 minutes north.
So that, there's no way. That's not going to work.
So it just had this catastrophic effect on Hobart as a whole. Not only were they grieving, they were reeling. I read somewhere that it wasn't like a disaster where, you know, there's a hurricane, so you could pitch in like helping to like repair the damage. Like, there was no damage aside from the bridge. So like the community couldn't help. So they just had to get on with things, but they couldn't get on with things because the city was cut in two. Both major hospitals are on the western side
and most of
the city's amenities, most schools, the uni, all of the like cultural center and everything like that is on the west, is in Hobart CBD. But 30% of the city's population lived on the east, but worked on the west. And there's no working from home in the 70s.
No.
Like, you had to go to work.
Working from home by dialing on the telephone.
Like, what could you do? A lot of women worked part-time in those days. They just had to quit because it just wasn't worth the commute. It basically took 2 hours, where it used to take 10 minutes.
Yeah.
If you were going, it was basically like unsealed roads back then, up to Bridgewater, which is super north. And then to come back down, it just took forever. They brought in 3 ferries from Sydney, and other small ferry services in Hobart were called up to take on the job. But the queues were insane for the ferries. Like, it was just, the vibes were off. The vibes were extremely off. The Time article, Bridge of Size, says that 30,000 commuters set out to go to work the next day. And we're just like, what the fuck are we doing? And there's a really good quote, and I'll quote it directly from the article because I like the way they wrote it. "For the people of the Eastern Shore, the bridge had been a taken-for-granted umbilical, not only to friends, relatives and jobs, but to schools, hospitals, government offices, banks, lawyers, dentists and even undertakers. The disaster left the community bewildered as well as isolated." So it was just like it had this awful effect. The Eastern Shore felt it the most. Mm-hmm. In the 6 months after the disaster, crime rose 41%, according to that Time magazine article. It fell on the western side. So crime went down on the west. On the east, it went up. Car theft went up 50%. Neighborhood fights and complaints went up 300%.
Why?
So people were just so angry at each other. They were just so frustrated.
People, like,
they were yelling at each other.
Yeah.
People who were commuting were tired and depressed. Like, alcohol sales went up like 1,000%. Mm. Like, marriages ended. Like, it was not good. And because at the bridge site, they were doing a lot of underwater surveying, it just looked like they weren't doing anything.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't like immediately putting up a new pier because they were like, hang on, we've got to check the damage down here before we just start rebuilding the thing. So it felt like it was slow. It just made people frustrated. But actually, they found the long ferry queues made for these kind of impromptu community gathering sites because people were like venting their spleens in the queue for the ferry. So like people airing their grievances. You know, there were no like psychologists back then. It was like
and I thought mental health was not exactly a top
no
of
one
mind
cared.
Issue.
So it was actually good. People were like then started to bond together. And now to this day, the Eastern Shore is a really strong community. They,
really?
You know, okay, they all yelled at each other for like 6 months.
And stole each other's
And then they
cars.
Bonded together.
Yep. Yep.
More amenities started to open. There's now a major shopping center there. There's medical facilities and small businesses started to pop up as well. But it took over 2 years for the bridge to reopen.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's so
long. I can't
imagine
it because it's so well used. It is just like it's essential.
Yeah.
A temporary bridge was constructed in December of that year. So that happened in Jan. So a year later, there was this temporary
Still
bridge.
Still a year.
A year. And it was like two lanes. So it was, again, pretty slow. It was rushed through because officials could see this detrimental effect that the lack of bridge was having just on society as a whole and on people. In October 1977, close to 3 years since its collapse, the rebuilt Tasman Bridge with an extra fifth lane and a brand new 18th pylon was reopened to traffic. The 19th pylon was never replaced because there was so much debris under the surface. It was unsafe.
Wow.
There's now new regulations for marine traffic, which is good. Mm-hmm. Vessels over a certain size need a trained pilot on board.
Right.
So that's what he didn't have. And
yeah.
So he, as you said, and rightly so, it was blamed on him because he didn't know what to do in that scenario. But now there's a trained pilot if it's over a certain size. And if vessels are big enough, they actually stop traffic going on the bridge. I've never seen that happen.
Mm.
I don't use the bridge very much because I'm terrified of it.
Yeah.
Because I live on the western side. So I only use it if I'm chauffeuring people to and from the airport, which I do when people visit me. I'm a very good host. But honestly, it gives me chills, the bridge, because I know this story and it just freaks me out.
Yeah, totally. And like, I suppose because they didn't fully replace it, right? Like they fixed it.
Yeah, they fixed it.
And obviously they've put in new strategies in place to prevent this happening again, but it's still the same bridge. Like you still kind of know that some of those pylons aren't going to withstand this happening again.
It's just eerie, I think.
Yeah.
Another bridge was built about 10 years later called the Bowen Bridge, nearer to my house, actually. It's halfway between the Tasman Bridge and that one further away. And the idea of that is literally to mitigate this happening again. Mm. Like if one of the other bridges is affected, there's this other one as a backup in case disaster strikes again. So while the bow of the ship has been removed, the SS Lake Illawarra still lies in the Derwent River.
Does
it's
it?
Deep enough to not be a hazard. That's how far it went down.
Oh,
it's not a hazard to any other ships, but it's still there because they just couldn't actually.
Have people like dived it?
Yeah, that people died. They got rid of the bow a few years ago, I think, and they've like surveyed it and everything. And I think they keep an eye on it to make sure it isn't moving and it isn't coming up and ships are going to run into it, but it's still there. And
that's
I think
creepy.
Some of the bodies too, probably.
Nope.
Yes.
Nope, that's weird. I don't like shipwrecks.
I know. So I've done like a shipwreck come bridge disaster story for you.
Yes.
And that is the story of the Tasman Bridge.
Oh, my God. That's
wild.
Crazy that you just drive on that.
Yes. I hate it. I actually hate it. I hate going on the bridge.
Oh, now that I know that, I don't think I can drive on the bridge.
Well, if you ever come,
yeah,
you kind of
like,
have
well,
to.
You're going to have to.
You have to. Unless
goodness.
You visit Launceston instead, which is the lesser city. I've now offended everyone in northern Tasmania.
Oh, dear.
Well, I really enjoyed that story. I was shocked. I had goosebumps multiple times.
I'm glad that you didn't know anything about
it. No, I didn't know anything about it. I feel like a lot of people listening wouldn't know that story.
Mm, I've been dying to do it for years.
Yeah.
I think since all Aussie Mystery Hour times, but it wasn't a mystery.
It's not
so
a mystery.
I couldn't.
It's just a story.
But yeah, I love a disaster. So I'll do something cheery next time, maybe.
Yeah. Well, speaking of all Aussie Mystery Hour, what we should tell everybody is our next episode. I think is going to be an all Aussie hour Mel or Josie's version. So like Taylor Swift has been re-recording her classic songs, we will be revisiting topics that we did years ago now. Like what, like 5 years ago now? Like
2018.
Yeah,
so
it's like six years ago.
Hate
that. Anyway, it's been a long time. There's new information. It's also fun to redo stories. Also, it's a, how do I say this? Like a, what do we say there? Like a legal.
Well, we also, legally, I'm allowed to. We don't own those episodes because we recorded them when we worked somewhere together.
Somewhere together. So now
we don't work there anymore.
Do them again because you can't own history. And
yes.
And that is a fact.
So we'll pick some, but if you are an old school fan, old school zesty, as we used to call our fans, our listeners, or just head over to that feed and see if you want any redone.
If you want any redone,
hit us
up, ask for a Mel or Josie version of that
there's
story.
Some classics. Well, we could suggest a few. There's what? Somerton Man, there's Lindy Chamberlain, Harold Holt.
Bunyips. I'm definitely going to do Bunyips and Yowies. Yeah. Actually, do you know one that I'm definitely going to do that I forgot I'd even done was Wilga Waterhole.
Tending to the Hut. Yeah, that was a good one.
Which you'll understand when we do our version of it. But yes, very excited for that. So keep listening, everyone.
Yep, join the group. Follow us on social media. You'll find all those details in the show notes.
And that's it.
Is it?
Hooroo.